Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. There's not a lot of people telling you this stuff, folks. So either they're just kind of holding back on the truth or whatever it is. These things you need to know. That debt is fraud. When we look at our government, the majority of what our government is doing is not authorized by our constitutions. This is pretty critical. I'm hoping that you start to understand this. And I say this because as we look at what government is to do for us, it is limited and defined within those constitutions. And it boggles my head looking at so many people that are suffering throughout the United States. And not one time do I hear people, you know, focusing all of their arguments on their constitutions. In other words, we've become a nation and a society of crybabies and whiners. Why? You know, how many times? Okay, so there's an adage that kind of maybe rings truth, right? Stereotypes and adages usually come from a level of truth, that the squeaky wheel gets the oil. The whiners always get the oil. And so bad behavior sometimes begets a reward, but it will never truly fix the problem. And so the only way we can move forward and the only way we can succeed is by doing the right things. Now, again, I say this, and I will concede every day of the week, if necessary, that we are going to have a real benefit with Trump in the presidency, financially, tax-wise, and certain things are going to get better. But the direction of what is going to happen and how things are going to play out will not be good. Because if we're not doing and we're not standing on the Constitution, we're not doing what we need to get into compliance, then we are heading in the wrong direction. You will know when we've turned that corner, when we have the ability to hold every public servant accountable to the supreme law of the land. Because the supreme law of the land demands that every public servant who has failed to support the Constitution, what we call, some people call the organic, the original text, and all of its amendments. There are no boogeymen in any of the amendments. No bad things. There's things that, you know, aren't necessarily the best, and we can, you know, we don't have to live with those, but though nothing in the amendments of the Constitution are our problem. Our problem is the government is either exercising powers that they don't have, implementing amendments that are not, you know, dictated within the amendment, like the 16th and 17th Amendments. They have actually been wrongfully implemented. And so when we look at what our problem is we are failing to hold public servants accountable. And Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is the law. It is the supreme law of the land that demands that every public servant who has violated their oath must be removed from office. So why is it that we're not taking a stand and using the Constitution as our shield, our defense, our weapon, and our destroyer of the evil among us? I have said this and said this and said this and said this. When we need to worry about the salvation of mankind, you need to pick up the scriptures of God. But when we need to save our liberty, save our nation, we need to pick up his scriptures that he gave us in governing, called the Constitution, and all of its ratifying debates and all of its amendments. And you will find that he gave us everything we need to restore our Constitution Republic. Now, I typically don't like putting, you know, time-dominant type of stuff into my shows, but I found it kind of interesting that as we look at today, or this time of year, it was April 4th that the general that was in Massachusetts was very, very concerned with the fact that the militias and the people of the colonies, especially in Massachusetts, were actually starting to stockpile weapons, ammo, powder, that type of stuff. And so he was very concerned because he even heard rumor and intelligence that out in Concord, they had a very large stockpile. And he was making plans to get out there to actually confiscate those stockpiles. That was the precursor. In other words, we have a hard document of this gentleman's diary entry on the 4th of April, where the shot that was heard around the world was forthcoming, that event was actually being planned out by our enemy. Where are we today in identifying what we need to be doing in stockpiling, you know, our knowledge? Because we do not need to fight a revolutionary war. We do not need the war or deadly force to take back this nation. We have everything we need in that Constitution. And your greatest weapon is the pen and paper. The greatest weapon we have, so this week I got a chance to once again hear somebody talking about interposition, and I think that this gentleman, he's primarily on the right path, but he's not talking about First Amendment petitions. He's not talking about using the true weapon of interposition. Interposition, the formal weapon that we use in the act of interposing, is a petition, identifying the violations and identifying and instructing what needs to happen to redress the grievances. So we're going to get into a lot of this stuff. And today being no different, because I told you I really want to focus on content. So, by the way, if you want to drive some content on this show, because we're doing treaties and we're doing other types of things out of the ordinary, reading of Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, the ratification debates, and so forth, and doing deep dives on very specific issues, like this past week, we talked about representation in detail. This past week, we also talked about, in context to the content, we talked about immigration. So I'm here to tell you that I am not seeking your dependence on me. I believe that anybody that actually seeks and searches the founding documents, the critical documents that created the framework of what we call the Constitution, this framework of government. The framework of government is not just the federal government. The framework of government, when you read the Constitution, is it only about the federal government? No. There are actually roles and responsibilities and powers that are granted to the state government and we the people, or preserved in that Constitution. Because when we look at the 10th Amendment, it says it right there. Powers that are not delegated in this Constitution or reserved from the states are basically reserved to the states and the people respectively. In other words, those things that we did not allow the federal government to do and that the states aren't prohibited from exercising by the Constitution, then though everything else is left to the states and we the people. It's interesting that they went out of their way to make sure that we knew these things. So, here to tell you, my friends, we need to, and this is all coming from this level of frustration I have, because I am telling you our greatest enemy are within our ranks. Because there's so many and too many, there's way too many people placing blind trust in the party. Way too many people placing blind trust in these institutions and organizations that have been around here, and they're really good people. They're church-going, they're Christians, and they're good people. But they will mislead you if necessary, because you know I'm critical of everybody. You know, when you listen to me, I am an equal opportunity, you know, truth giver, or a person that will not hesitate to point to organizations how they are the problem. And they don't like that, and that's okay. I don't think Trump likes, you know, and unfortunately, I've really tried to make it seem like I don't hate Trump. I hate those things that are being done that are not constitutional, and I hate unconstitutional acts and actions. We need to get into compliance with the Constitution, so at least I'm consistent, unlike these other organizations and so forth. So, anyway, what we've got today, because I'm going through the Treaty of Ghent. I've been asked to go through the Treaty of Paris, which is what we went through on Monday. And I'm doing this because there are conservative organizations or people that, you know, we think are patriots, you know, and I think they're Christian, but I don't think there are patriots, because a patriot is somebody that truly supports in America. In America, a patriot is not somebody who supports their country or their government. In America, we're obligated as citizens to be patriots of the Constitution, which is why we are required to take up arms to defend not the government, not a person, not an office, not a party. We are required to take up arms to support and defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. We've gotten for years and years and years, nobody ever wanted to point the finger at those people who were criticizing the Constitution and actually wait. And today they've gotten to a point where they're not just criticizing, they're getting away with exercising an insurgency against the Constitution. These are American citizens. And some of these people, as I'm trying to bring this all back around, some of these people that are waging this insurrection against the Constitution, you're looking at as really patriots or constitutionalists, when they're only giving you 95% of the truth, and the big 5% lies that they're telling you are keeping you and I from working together and holding public servants completely accountable. They don't go there. Oh, we don't get involved in the elections. We don't do those things. And the party is so, so guilty. John Birchers, every single one of these organizations that fail to put aside their organizational interests over us supporting and demanding full compliance of the Constitution and holding every public servant accountable. This is a constitutional duty and responsibility of all of us to do these things. Why is it that nobody is doing First Amendment petitions? God bless Bob Schultz. God bless that great man, because he's the one that actually started forging the way into helping people understand how important this one thing is. There are other people that have become advocates for the First Amendment petition. I think John Gentry, I give credit to the guy that is in Tennessee that is driving this. But unfortunately, the First Amendment petition is not the only process, because when we actually look at moving forward and taking full control over our government. It is not First Amendment petitions, it's constitutional petitions. In other words, when the parties to the Constitution demand compliance, those aren't First Amendment petitions. First Amendment petitions are where we petition government for the redress of grievances, we the people. But when county commissioners, county supervisors petition their state legislature for compliance, that is a constitutional petition. When the states collectively demand republic review, demand full accountability and full compliance to the U.S. Constitution by the federal government, that is, it's republic review, but that is constitutional petition. That is a constitutional petition demanding full compliance. And those directives that will be provided by the county commissioners as supervisors, whatever you call your county legislators, as well as the state legislators going to the federal government, county to the state, states to the federal Congress. We are a representative body, and it is the representative bodies to that representative body created by the body of representatives of the counties and states, the parties themselves being representative in a representative government, go to the body they created, representative body, to say, you will comply, or we will drag you by your hair, by your feet, whatever is necessary, out of your positions and replace you. And so this is a conversation we're hoping to actually start engaging with states, because states need to start holding themselves and others accountable. Anyway, we're going to dive into the Treaty of Ghent. And your campaign begins today as you appeal to heaven, make sure you continue to learn, pray, and act. And don't forget that it's all about holding everybody accountable. And we need to retool our government to ensure that at the drop, that the suggestion that somebody has violated their oath, that needs to be seriously investigated, seriously taken, and actually resolved constitutionally by a trial by jury, or actually by a, not a jury trial, but a trial of trial by jury. Yeah, a jury trial is where the judge presides and basically instructs. A trial by jury is where we the people make the choice. We make the decisions, and we use the law as our guide. Now, the Treaty of Peace, right, amid this, the king and the great majesty, you know, you would actually look at the way the king of Britain referred to himself and looked, and the way the documentation refers to him, you would think this man is a huge polity. Now, the Treaty of Ghent of 1814, kind of interesting. What I want to do is I want to cover what we call the overview, an overview of this, because it's 7 pages. I don't want to read all 7 pages, and that makes kind of a boring show. But what I want to do is kind of give you the background first. First off, the Treaty of Ghent is the closure of the Revolutionary War. In other words, it's finally Britain acknowledging that they have no ability to drag us back underneath them, that they have to let us go. Now, the interesting thing is that that was punctuated in the following year because of the Battle of New Orleans. Again, this treaty was signed December 24th of 1814, and it ended that war and what we would consider this great revolution against the world empire. The only ones that did it, folks, and they're still the world's empire today. Even though everybody looks at us, we're basically in league with them as well as the globalists. And we need to cut those strings. And the only way we're going to do that is republic review. Anyway, the treaty restored the pre-war boundaries, and we're going to kind of cover each of those. I'm going to only highlight certain things out of this. But it all it did was really restore all of the different boundaries and actually kind of restored vessels taken and so forth. And so the fact is that this thing was actually signed on what they called Christmas Eve. But in America, we still were not recognizing Christmas Eve. And it's interesting that when you read our history books, why is it that they refer to this day as Christmas Eve? When there's no states in the Union at this point in time that was even recognizing Christmas. I do a program on Christmas that actually gives you the full history of how Christmas evolved in America and how it actually became a world event in driving financial markets, period. So when we look at what was happening and Britain finally coming to the conclusion that with the technology that they possessed, they would never be able to truly take America back. They cannot project enough warfare and force to basically manhandle us into coming back into their Commonwealth. So, after this 2 years of prosecuting a war and realizing that there's just, they were heading down the exact same path that we would basically attrit their resources, by basically dwindling, them down to nothing. And we were actually kicking their butts. Technically, up to this point going into it, Britain had finally came to the conclusion that even though what on paper, what was looking like they had an advantage, they were nowhere close to the strategic advantage that they would have needed by that point in time to overwhelm us. And as a matter of fact, we were at the point of things turning and they knew this. And so let me get into how things turned, because we need to look at the Battle of New Orleans. So before the Treaty of Ghent actually got down to Andrew Jackson, who was down in Louisiana, he basically led American forces in a decisive butt-kicking, in American fashion, butt-kicking Battle of New Orleans on January 8th, 1815. And this victory, despite the war had already been over, boosted the American morals and basically, helped lift and buoy our spirits to ensure the treaty's ratification. So in other words, if Britain had any inkling that they might be able to revisit this again, because they already came to the conclusion when they started these entreatments of, looking for peace again, because their strategic interests were not being met by this certain point in time. They said, we need to start pursuing peace because we don't want to be, drawn and quartered, or we don't want to actually let this linger to where it becomes too costly. They were only going to invest so much. And I'm telling you, folks, they actually cut our head off. Britain cut our head off. They came into Washington, D.C., and they burned that town down. They burned all of our documents and or stole stuff from us. And so when we go through this treaty, all of that stuff was to be restored. And so as we move forward in looking at everything that was happening, the significance of this treaty really made more of an alliance with Britain and America in fighting slavery than anything else. And so actually that's a part of this treaty. So when we actually look at the treaty, because I'm going to go into break now. So when we come back, I'm going to dive into this and we're going to dive into each of the articles and what in a summation as to what these things do. For the most part, they're only restoring the lands and so forth that was either gained or was already in possession or however, because Britain was really trying to maintain, their positioning through this treaty, because I think that when they were doing this treaty, they were planning on coming back. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so one of the things that kind of is interesting that you notice in these documents, and this is not a common word, and I pointed this out on Monday, that they referred to the respective, the ministers, those people who were going to do all of the treaty work, plenipotentiaries. And in other words, it's a word for an ambassador or a person that has all the power necessary to make the original agreements. Again, these treaties by these plenipotentiaries, because when we hear people talk about a plenipotentiary today, that is a person that can actually make the decisions and execute them. And that's not the case. And so it is really more of just an ambassador that has the ability to, you know, make, you know, pending agreements, but not permanently at that point in time make the agreement. So anyway, when we look at what this is, we'll find that John Quincy Adams plays a key role in this, as well as Henry Clay and James Baird on the American side. Now, in the very first article, we're actually going to find that everything that they actually have is going to be restored. As a matter of fact, they want to make sure that everything is all done. And actually, right here, they talk about the exchanging of, you know, all of the ships, wars, possessions, property, all of that, even slaves. And so they go down this path of identifying that everything is going to be restored, that they're all committed to restoring this. The part that I find is interesting is where Britain wanted to maintain its close proximity. So this goes back to when we took land away because of the war. We started taking some of the islands up, going up to Nova Scotia, some bays and so forth. Britain wanted that stuff back. And the reason they wanted that back is I think they still wanted to maintain very close proximity to be able to launch maybe another attack. And they, because again, when they were going into this treaty, technically they were kind of winning, but they weren't gaining what they needed. And we were starting to actually fight back. And we were actually, because we were caught off guard. We were caught off guard. They wiped out D.C., and it forced President James Madison, our smallest president in stature, and probably one that had, you know, the infirmities because of his, you know, his bilge or whatever they call that. I've talked about that before, where, you know, he just had digestive problems. And so he was the only president to actually lead troops in battle. Now, George Washington led troops in battle, but he wasn't president at the time. The only president during warfare actually leading troops in battle. So that was huge. So when we look at this, it basically says, and this is key, all archives, records, deeds, and papers, either of a public nature or belonging to private persons, which in the course of the war may have fallen into the hands of the officers or other party shall be, as far as may be practicable, forthwith restored and delivered to the proper authority and persons to whom they respectively belong. That was all American papers that belonged to Americans and or our government that they were taking and confiscating. We wanted it all back. And so that right there was key. This is in the very first article. And then, so that was our demand. And then to flip it over, such of the islands of the Bay of Passamaquoddy, which however you pronounce that, which is right there by Nova Scotia, right at the very tip of Maine, as are claimed by both parties, shall remain in the possession of the party in whose occupation they may be at the time of the exchange of the ratifications of this treaty, until the decision respecting the title to the said islands shall have been made in conformity with the fourth article of this treaty. So in other words, they're going to make some deals down below, so we're going to allow you to keep the land that anybody's assumed, but we're going to go through and verify the legitimate lands, because what England does in this treaty is they refer back to the Treaty of 1783. In other words, that grand treaty of peace, right? And as a matter of fact, they use this term a lot when I actually find this. It is, they refer to that treaty as the Treaty of 1783. So I highlight this, or actually I made it all caps, so that it just stands out, that when you look for 1,007, or the instances of this, you'll actually find that they mention it seven times, and then they also refer to it as the Treaty of Paris. So in other words, Britain is kind of going all the way back to, we want to restore the land and so forth the way it was by that treaty. But they had to stipulate, and so this is where we said, we had some contention with that. And so we're allowing certain things to go back to Britain and or America and or even the Indians. So they actually get into this. And so in the very first treaty, they basically talk about the exchange after the ratification of this treaty of, you know, any slaves, private property, and all of that type of stuff. But going further in the second article, this is where they identify, you know, the ships and all of these things that need to be taken back, as well as this latitudes. Now, they talk about the latitudes of the earth where the possessions may be. And then they create these stipulations that, you know, if it's in this quadrant, that you have this many days to get it back to us. And then when they talk about the rest of the world, you know, which is basically south of the equator, you know, the things that Britain may have taken from us, like ships that are somewhere else on in the world, in a, you know, the other side of the planet, you have 120 days to get those articles back to us. So in other words, this second article really makes sure that we create these timelines of when they have to restore the articles back to us that they took. Because it's not like we went and took a whole bunch of stuff and went around the world hiding it from them. So this second article was an article aimed at Britain of having to restore every ship, piece of property that they have taken and taken it out of the area. So without exceptions, they had to restore all of this. And then all prisoners of war in the third article, on either side, as well as land of sea and so forth, that was practical, that they had to actually restore all of them and and basically make sure that they provide for them until they're restored, all that. The fourth article is where they start dividing the land up and going through these very specific commissions. They create and when you go through this, you'll realize that they create this commission that they will go through and walk through the treaty, again, the Treaty of 1783, and they will determine whether the land is there or not and who gets it. And this is how it goes, and this is how Britain kind of covered their sixes on this, or their backsides. because it's the very end, and it says, "And His Britannic Majesty and the Government of the United States hereby agree to refer the report or reports of the said commissioners to some friendly state or sovereign or state to be named then for that purpose, and who shall be requested to decide on the differences which may stand in the said report or reports upon the report of the commissioner together with the grounds upon which the other commissioners shall have refused, declined, or admitted to act as the case may be. And if the commissioner so refusing, declining, or admitting to act, shall also willfully admit to the state grounds of, upon which he has so done in such manner that the said statement may be referred to such friendly sovereign or state, together with the report of such other commissioner and such sovereign state shall decide ex parse upon the said report, and His Majesty and the Government of the United States engage to consider the decision to be final." Okay, so in other words, this is a lot of speak to basically say, we're going to go to a third party that's supposedly indifferent that we'll agree upon, and we will actually, you know, refer to them. And, you know, and hopefully we'll agree, because that's what how they end this. And His Britannic Majesty and the Government of the United States engage to consider the decision of such friendly state and or state to be final and conclusive on all matters to be referred. So what is the key part here? Engage to consider the decision as final. Doesn't mean that they're obligated to. So in other words, Britain was basically giving themselves an out, but gave us an out as well. It was a double out for both sides. So here's the reality. I believe that this treaty was laying it out that Britain was going to try to, you know, kill us by paper cuts, right? Just a little, you know, doing this. And to be clear, when we really look at the world at this point in time, Britain was the emperor or the empire that was ruling the world. And so they had advantages. So the only way we could have actually had an impartial third-party state or sovereign to decide the question that would be coming out of this and the rest of these statements, because this you'll find this statement at the end of most of these articles, that if we can't agree, then we're going to go down this path, and we're going to repeat this, and we're going to do it again, and we're going to do it again. And these they create these different commissioners as well. One commissioner goes off and tries to settle this part of the dispute. Another one goes over here and tries to settle this part of the dispute. The point is that I think Britain was baking it so that they wouldn't be committed to surrendering anything, and or the United States wouldn't be committed, because Britain had its plans in determining how much they wanted to keep or violate of this treaty, because they realize that they may have to take a different strategy in attacking and bringing us back into the Commonwealth. Painfully doing so with harsh punishments and so forth, but bottom line, that what ended up happening in the Battle of New Orleans changed everything. Britain realized that there's just no way they could ever extend enough deadly force to come into a land and an area that was so immense, greater than the kings of Europe by this point in time. When we really look at the kingdoms of Europe that Britain was trying to maintain and manage the controls over them, as well as the rest of the world, there was no way. Our population was growing. I'd actually have to go and look at the census of 1810, but we were in the tens of millions by this point in time. And looking at Britain and how many little people lived on that little island and who they were controlling, they were way too far extended to be able to try to deal with America ever again. which is why they waited and took sides with the South during the Civil War, and they used money to undermine us. In other words, they didn't attack us, but after the Civil War, they threatened to. Anyway, so let's go into the fifth article. And the fifth article pretty much basically is dividing this area of the River Iroquois or Cataquois and so forth. They wanted this all to be, you know, surveyed. And this is the province of New Brunswick. So this is up by the Canada border. Again, that's where most of the dispute lands were, or in the western lands. And anyway, the point that I want to point out is the same thing. And in the event of the said commissioners differing or both, or either of them refusing, declining, or willfully admitting to act, such reports, declarations, statements shall be made by them or either of them, and such reference to a friendly sovereign state shall be made in all respects in the latter part of the fourth article is contained, because this is the fifth article now, is contained, and in as full a manner as if the same was herein repeated. In other words, they're going to do the same thing, and both sides will consider the validity and or, you know, the outcome. In other words, another, you know, whole article of a point of contentions on boundaries and so forth that they would consider whether they were going to honor it or not. In other words, there was a lot of, you know, wasted paper and space because both sides were adamant that they weren't moving forward. Now, I'll give you this other little ancillary piece. Because there was still this hope that the Federalists would be coming back, that the Federalists were actually going to be coming back when Britain attacked us, because the Federalists were the Anglophiles. They were the ones that were seeking, you know, this alignment with Britain and to be able to improve relationships. When Britain attacked us, that was crap. Hit the fan, and it all landed on the Federalists. And that ended up basically securing the demise and the annihilation of the Federalist Party. Because the Federalist Party, again, was really trying to, you know, counter. Because in Madison's election, they were really trying to counter, you know, his and Jefferson's prominence in moving forward. And they thought that they were actually going to get there, and Britain just screwed them over big time, because after the attack, the Federalists had to go hide. They ended up abandoning. This is why Monroe, in his second election or his re-election, Monroe was basically unanimously selected. There were no Federalist electors at all. Anyway, the sixth article. This is interesting, though. The sixth article is where they get into some other stuff. They're still talking, again, about Lake Superior moving westward over the northern boundary and trying to secure that. And so this is the part I want to read. In order, therefore, this is the last part of this. In order, therefore, finally to decide these doubts, they shall refer to the two commissioners appointed, and just like before, that they will go to, you know, a third party. The said commissioners shall meet in the first instances in Albany, State of New York, and shall have power to adjourn to such a place or places that they shall think fit. The said commissioners shall, by a report or declaration under the hands and seals, designate the boundary through the said river and lakes and water communications, and decide to which the two contracting parties and the several islands of, you know, will go forward. And so they talk again about these boundaries that were established in the Treaty of 1783. And both parties agree to consider such designation as decision as final and conclusive. And in the event that the said commissioners differ or both willfully admit blah, 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 then they shall go back and basically repeat the same thing that the United States and this King Majesty, this, you know, his the Grand Poobah of England, will, you know, consider agreeing one way or the other. In other words, there was all nothing but room for dispute out of each of these articles. So in the seventh article, again, they mentioned that same treaty, and it basically went through the said boundaries and latitudes of the Northwest Point and the Lake of the Woods. So in other words, they were still going, you know, moving westward along the boundaries of America where Britain was trying to maintain their toehold. The eighth article is where these men basically talked about more boundaries moving forward and basically the same crap. The ninth article and so forth, but here is the kicker. The 10th article is where Britain and America finally agree and they kind of join arms and go kumbaya. Because, again, I believe and I look at this treaty not as a bad thing for America, because what they were basically doing was they were creating this agreement to say, okay, we're going to honor the old boundaries and go through all of these different boundaries and areas because Britain was occupying the whole world. Don't forget, we bought the Pacific Northwest from Britain, and we bought, you know, Alaska from Russia. We actually wanted to go further north with the British into British Columbia and so forth, but bottom line, you know, things were starting to move forward, and we ended up buying the Pacific Northwest before the Civil War because by that point in time, Britain was basically thinking there's just nothing they can do. They had to let us go. They were hoping, and I think they just had it. So at any point, if we ever saw an opportunity to be able to successfully undermine America so that we could hurt them and take them back, we will seize that opportunity. And the Civil War was that such thing. The Article of the 10th, and I think this is where the United States government, along with Britain, actually help promote and move forward this concept of the Civil War. This is what it says. Whereas the traffic in slaves is irreconcilable with the principles of humanity and justice, and whereas both His Majesty and the United States are desirous of continuing their efforts to promote its entire abolition, it is hereby agreed that both the contracting parties shall use their best endeavors to accomplish so desirable of an object. After the Treaty of Ghent, this is one part of the treaty that was embraced and actually executed. We created a bond with Britain in abolishing slavery throughout the world. If you want to know what happened to slavery, we started, and this was all about the slave trade. So we were going and abolishing the slave trade, but it ended up abolishing slavery throughout the world. Today, slavery is alive and well and growing in the world today. What happened? How is it that we were able to contain probably all and end almost all of slavery? There were very few places that still had slavery, very few, and now it's growing. It's growing in the Islamic states, big time, and it's growing in, you know, in China, in communism, and so forth. As a matter of fact, we look at this new age of slavery, you're either a slave or you're incarcerated as literally a body to be used to, you know, take your parts of your body from you and put them in somebody else. How evil is that? Anyway, when we look at the ending of this treaty, the 11th article, it basically says, this treaty, when the same shall have been ratified on both sides, without alteration by either contracting parties, and the ratifications mutually exchanged, shall be binding on both parties, and ratifications shall be exchanged at Washington in the space of 4 months from this day, or sooner if practicable, in faith whereof we, the respective plenipotentiaries, have signed this treaty and have hereunto affixed our seals, done in triplicate at Ghent the 24th day of December 1814. Now, when we look at what ended up happening, right after this treaty was signed and so forth, where Britain was going to go back and go, you know what? We still have the opportunity. We, you know, we're not just putting this aside. We have the opportunity to unconsider and not follow these things because we don't agree with, or we want to maintain our ability to get and stick it to America. The war, or the Battle of New Orleans, changed everything. It was such a divisive butt-kicking that Britain took. It ended everything. And what ended up happening is Britain basically started conceding. They seemed to act more gentlemanly, and they were honoring their treaties, and they were actually working in what we perceive was becoming an alliance with them, until the Civil War, when all of a sudden they opened up their banks and they started bringing gold and silver to America, or actually using their gold and silver to bring, you know, armaments, goods, and so forth to bolster the Southern forces so that they could kill and destroy the Union that was so ominous and such a threat to them. And when that happened, there was no doubt what ended up happening in the 14th Amendment was such a severe blow that Britain basically executed a political coup by pouring money in and corrupting American politicians to literally sign away, by starting off with the Organic Act in making an unconstitutional state called Washington, D.C., and creating a governor and state and moving that land into statehood, or the goal, moving that land into statehood, was literally the next subversive act that Britain was basically working in league with our political class of America to undermine America. The interesting thing, folks, is regardless of what they were capable of doing, they couldn't get us to the point of the precipice where they could flick us off and destroy us. The world hates America. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, all of our great framers and great leaders recognized how they hated us for our liberty. They still hate us because we have this thing that guarantees liberty. And they see that the governing class and the globalists of the world today see that as the greatest threat, because it is the one thing that appeals to all people, liberty. So it is their greatest threat, which is why they have to destroy us. And we were so warned of this hate and animosity that they contained. And so this is why I keep telling you that the Constitution actually allows any state in the world to become a state in the United States. That they don't have the ability to just join, you know, out of turn. We have to basically set parameters and thresholds to bring them in so that they don't, you know, fail, and that they actually help America in its goals and strategies succeed in becoming the beacon of liberty throughout the world. It's that simple, folks. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.